I suppose when I first started reading about Russian Christianity, inevitably I read a bit about Dostoevsky, about the 19th century, and particularly about the Brothers Karamazov, about the way in which the great debate is staged between belief and unbelief there, and the very significant role played there by the whole Russian tradition of spiritual elders, spiritual fathers, Father Zosima, in the book. And that connected with a lot of what I was interested in, and later on when I studied Russian theology more intensively, I could see something where that tradition came from.
Dostoevsky isn't exactly a comfortable believer in any way at all. I mean, it's particularly when one starts to think about questions of faith and the Russian nature of faith, which seems to be very different from Western faith. It's a rocky road he takes you along.
Very much so. He has no easy answers. But I think what struck me when I first read the Grand Inquisitor episode in Karamazov was there is absolutely no form of words that's going to give you a solution to suffering. Absolutely none. And that's why what ends the conversation, or the, not conversation, the kind of arraignment by the Inquisitor of the captive Jesus, is silence, and then Jesus kisses him. And you can say that means everything or nothing. There's no solution, and at the same time, there's a relationship. And I think when I first read it, I had a kind of dim sense that there was something very, very important in that, that what you look for in faith is not solutions, but the sense of relationship.
And that's characteristic of Dostoevsky's fiction, isn't it? There are very few solutions. There are no last words.
No, and that's a point I try to make in the book, that as soon as you think you've got the system that answers all the questions, you've done something irreparably awful to your human nature. You've said that, you know, there is an end to talking, and that's an end to humanity for Dostoevsky in some ways. Now, of course, that's where Dostoevsky as a journalist and Dostoevsky as a novelist seem to belong to two different worlds. Dostoevsky the journalist is an appalling old ranter. He's a bigot, he's an anti-Semite, he's a passionate and uncritical Russian nationalist. He wants everybody to go and sign up and go and defend the Serbs against the Turks. And reading the writer's journal is not a, you know, not an easy experience. And then you turn to the novels and you find that he's again and again questioning what he himself has said. And I mentioned it in the book once or twice, but I think it's a very significant thing that some of the formulations that meant most to him as expressing his own faith, he will present in the novels in a slightly kind of cold light, a slightly almost satirical light. So the great phrase about my Hosanna has passed through the crucible of doubt, he puts into the mouth of the devil in Brother Karamazov, as if to say, okay, so you think you've got it, beware.
Quite, yeah. But there is a thought that some of Dostoevsky's concerns are absolutely alien to us. The questions of the church courts are alien. That in the Devils, another novel, his treatment of pre-revolutionary radicals is irrelevant. And yet you insist in the book repeatedly that this is a novelist whose concerns are very contemporary, very important for us now. I mean, you talk about absent fathers and abused children and all those kind of questions, the questions of broken society, questions of nationalism. Could you say a little bit about how you see Dostoevsky as being relevant to us now in that sense?
I first read Devils, I think, in about 1971. And one thing I remember very vividly still is, having had a little bit of my share of student radicalism, thinking that the depiction of the radical students' meeting was horribly recognisable. The kinds of arguments, the kind of personalities,
yeah.
The obsessional quality of it all, I thought, oh, been there. And that's just a very small bit of the whole spectrum here, but I think that what's going on in Devils, about what happens where you have, if like, a reduction of politics to management, the giving over of that management into the hands of people who have no moral hinterland, well, it rings a few bells in the contemporary world. Because it eventually privileges the person who is the most skillful manipulator. So the person who emerges triumphantly from that dreadful book, and it's a really frightening book as well as a very funny one, the person who emerges quite unscathed is the manipulator-in-chief, the one who has known exactly how to fine-tune all these radical groups with their naivety and their short-sightedness and narrowness, and made them perform according to his will. And you realize at the end of the day, it doesn't matter a bit to him. Now, that's not contemporary politics, but it just prompts the question. So when you don't have real shared values, real common goals in a society, aren't you going to be a bit at the mercy of the manipulator? How do you check that and control that? How do you avoid politics falling into the hands of, well, you know, the person who can press the most right buttons at the right moments, but who has no particular goals or aims himself or herself? As always with Dostoevsky, it's kind of projection to the extreme. It's not saying that this is what it's like, and it probably wasn't like that in the 1850s, 1860s. But the question's there.
The atheists do not have a foundation. That, you know, the famous quotation is that without God, everything's permitted. That's not quite what you're saying. I mean, in fact, this represents a different test for what a good ethical foundation could be.
Yes, and I think what's interesting in Dostoevsky that while he says or puts into the mouth of certain people, without God, everything is permitted, he allows you to see that there are people with all sorts of beliefs and levels of unbelief who are decent, compassionate, and loving. There are confused people. There are skeptical people. There are silly people like Stepan in Devils, and they still manage somehow to wriggle their way towards decency. He's not writing them off. But I think when that without God everything is permitted dictum comes up, what he's saying is not so much without God everybody would be bad, as without God we'd have no way of connecting one act with another, no way of developing a life that made sense. It would be really indifferent whether we did this or that. And I think it's that sense of God being part of what you draw on to construct a life that makes sense. That's what he's...
We have this quotation, this is you, I beg your pardon, glossing Dostoevsky, saying, only love directed towards the transcendent can generate effective and selfish love in the world. And that's his view. Is it yours too?
At the end of the day, yes, it is, because I believe that's how the universe is. I believe that God has made the world such that this is what we're for. Now, people can tune into that without the ideas being clear. Even when they reject that at the ideas level, they can still sense that's how it is. They can act as if there were an infinite, and that's one of the things that keeps the world going.
Well, this may be why Dostoevsky's still worth reading, why your book's worth reading, particularly for people in the West mired in a kind of Western individualism. But there is this concept throughout, well, in Dostoevsky's work of personalism, which is, it touches on what you've been talking about. Could you explain what that means and why it's kind of relevant now?
I'm very interested you use the word, because it's a tradition in Russian philosophy that's hugely powerful. And from Dostoevsky's friend Solovyov right through to much more recent writers, some of the underground philosophers in Russia in the Soviet days, and a lot of the émigrés, that's been crucial. And many of the Russians would say, you have to have a way of telling the difference between a person and an individual. An individual is somebody who, if you like, occupies a territory, possesses a space, and that's all you need to know. And to be an individual, you need to know where your space is and how to protect it. End of story. To be a person is to be someone who hears and answers, to be someone who doesn't just occupy a territory, but occupies a place in a network. But you need a flow chart to talk about persons. A person is what happens when someone speaks to you, acts upon you, and you respond. That also means, of course, that destructive words and violent actions erode your personal capacity. You become less capable of relating the less people speak love to you. So back to children again, back to the the awful, bruised, abused childhoods of all the brothers in Karamazov. And you see, in their different ways, they're all of them diminished persons. They all have to grow towards it or not. And I think personalism is not simply saying, as a philosophical principle, the most important thing is the particular person. It's to say the human project, the human enterprise, is about those exchanges and relations by which, once again, we build one another up. We take responsibility for each other's flourishing. We ourselves recognize that we're made, shaped into life. We take part in that shaping.
You wrote about Marx the other week, and you cited, there are going to be slight areas where you are apart from Marx, but nonetheless, the bewitchment of our society by a form of unbridled capitalism is something which you frown upon and he frowned upon.
The idea that I think most struck me when I read Marx first years and years ago was this notion that unbridled, overambitious capitalist venture always leads you to, in the jargon, to reify what you're talking about. Here is money, which is actually a medium of exchange and action between specific agents. Here is this thing treated as if it were an object with a life of its own. And you know, Marx is pretty sharp on that. That's why he saw the capitalist error, as he would regard it, as rather like the religious error. You're talking about something as if it had a life of its own, whereas God is just a function of how we relate to one another. Money is just a function of how we relate to one another. Now, I think obviously he was wrong about God in a big way, but some of what he said about money was right. And he'd just put his finger on that persistent temptation to treat what's actually within our reach and our agency as if it were outside. Mm.
Just to go back to Dostoevsky, you start the book with what seems like a broadside against the triumphalist atheists of the Dawkins, Grayling, Hitchens school. Is this book a kind of corrective to those people who've written about religious faith in a way that you would regard as dubious?
It's an indirect riposte, I suppose, though that wasn't the motive for writing it. But I often feel as I read Richard Dawkins or Christopher Hitchens, well, this isn't quite it. I don't know many people who think like this. And that's where, of course, in The Idiot, when Prince Mishkin says, when I hear atheists talking about Christianity, I don't recognize what they're talking about. I thought it might not do any harm just to put on a marker about that and say, well, here is a form of Christian engagement with the world and with the complexities of human experience that may be radically wrong, but is not cheap or glib. And any critique has to deal with this just as much as it has to deal with a Southern Baptist.
It's always bad to go by a dust jacket, but the dust jacket says that this book should be heartening to Christians and those searching for faith. Do you regard it as being so?
I hope it'll encourage Christians to be aware that there are writers and thinkers who've plumbed the depths, who've looked at humanity in its shadows as well as its triumphs, and who still think it's worth sticking with the Christian gospel. So that it's not encouraging or comforting in the sense that, oh, it's all right, we can relax. There are answers. Much more to say there are some people who've lived with the questions and come through.
Dr. Williams, thank you very much.